Okay, so the plan is, I don't know if everyone's heard, the plan is that we do about an hour now, and then that we take advantage of the what remains of the remains of the day, as it were, to go on a boat ride, yeah? And not on this boat, but on a different boat, and then at dusk we come back and have today's closing session, because with the lights we can work here a little bit later on before going for dinner. Actually, we've kind of skipped ahead in terms of what was laid out in the definition of suitably slack conditions for the day, and dealt at the same time with what we call the dynamics of naming and word mapping and lexical cartography, in other words, defining what needs to be defined. But I thought maybe we could start the afternoon session by coming back to a point which I think is what struck me as being potentially very rich, a remark that Nishant made, and then the discussion moved in all sorts of bifurcated ways. But to come back with an interesting distinction that you made, Nishant, in distinguishing participation from stakeholdership, that the participant is in a relationship with a community, whereas a stakeholder is in relationship with a network in which each nodal point has an equal stake. And since I'm not familiar with those dynamics, but they strike me as very promising, I'd like to invite you to start the session with a...
Well, I don't have a very articulate theory of it yet, but I think there are some things which do strike to me as interesting. I think there has been for some time, especially when we talk about attention and gift economies, a certain notion of an actor network theory, which seems to replicate a participant community model as well. That here is an actor who's this untainted, glorified, enlightened person who enters into a network condition and then enables as if the network, so that you are in the network condition, but you are also outside of it in many ways. That you are, in some ways, the objective anthropologist who has entered into this space either as an artist or as a researcher or as an interventionist. And that there are certain kinds of changes that you will effect in that particular space, but you will also then in very cursorily reflexive way talk about how it has produced a new subjectivity for yourself, how there is a reciprocity. The reciprocity is always only two ways, from the individual to the community and from the community back to the individual. The network theory, I think, comes and complicates the notions, because the individual is not addressing a community, but actually a set of relationships within that community which can be defined by a network model. So if we look upon the network as producing, at least on paper or in theory, equal nodes of opportunity, so that they might be of different sizes and they might be performing different kinds of roles, but that each particular node has a vested interest. And I'm using this in a very, very strategic way, saying that it is, for me, it becomes redundant to try to gloss over the fact that there is a takeaway or a stake or a vested interest in any of the work that we do. So, you know, that each node has a certain vested interest in trying to sustain that network by strengthening the relationships which they have started, and also building upon them certain kinds of superstructures which will then help them imagine not only the shape and the condition of the network, but also how each one of them is only as strong as the network is, and that the network is actually as weak as its weakest link, so that it is in the interest of the entire set of practitioners or the nodal points to come together and help. And this is not help in either a developmentalist empowering sort of a way. This is not even help in terms of granting speech or granting conditions, but bringing people at the level of a peer, because you recognize them to begin with as peers, not as somebody who either needs to be reformed or made aware of their natural wisdom or be rehabilitated into new forms of economic productions or skills or need to be preserved, but somebody who needs to be brought up to a certain level of commonality that the network has kind of understood itself upon, and that it is in their own interest to do this, which leads to a very interesting dynamism for me, because we're no longer talking about a one-way reciprocity or a cause and effect relationship, which I think is sometimes because of the representational model of community and participation that we have in place. Because it's not saying that because I did this, this happened, and so this happened to me as well. What you are saying is that instead of this represented self, which is in the representation does this, gives this certain kind of arrogance, which talks about how the self that I am presenting or projecting here is a true and accurate and an objective, verifiable self which is entering into that condition, and that these are the kind of changes I can mark upon the self. These are the kind of changes I can attribute to the self, saying that this is how I affected this particular space. So if we start thinking of the network model and the self within that as a simulated self rather than a distributed self rather than a represented self, in terms that your own subjectivity is only the beginning point of defining the selfhood. That the network, because of its relationships and because of its sometimes unpredictable ways of dealing with each of the nodes, adds to your understanding of the self. So it's neither a reduction of the self nor an elevation of it, but saying that it is the production of a peer self, which is possible because of the distributed system within which that self is then presented. For me, that becomes very enabling, largely as a researcher, because I don't then have to deal with questions of ethics about what is my privileged position, what am I doing in this condition, how am I representing that work in a certain kind of a way, because all output is looked upon as created in conditions of simulation with equal participation, and equality being a very neutral term in terms that some people within a network sustain the network by doing nothing, because they are nodes through which things have to pass sometimes. Some people within the networks are actors where they are actively making interventions or certain kinds of points or effective changes. There are other kinds of people within the network who actually serve as capillaries through which different kinds of processes are kind of enacted in some form or the other. So we're also talking about non-hierarchizing the roles within this community and the self-interaction sort of a thing, because otherwise you always have the artist or the interventionist or the researcher in some sort of a privileged position who has a voice, who has the vocabulary, who has a conceptual framework, and who at the end of the day is, in an India artist, is some sort of proto-Gandhian figure who will now transform this community by giving its means of production, means of talking about themselves. So it goes into this empowering debate sort of a thing. So I was wondering if one of the ways by which to look at this relationship between the artist or the interventionist and the population, let's say, is through a network model, and also getting away from then representation, which has its own sets of problems, in also terms of producing certain kinds of frames of realism through which meaning can be made and so on, and look at a post-realism or a hyper-realism kind of a model, which is largely about simulation. And for me, you know, facetious as it might seem, Facebook becomes the epitome of what a simulated self is about. That despite your extreme articulateness and despite the need to constantly talk about who you are, what you do, who you are connected to on Facebook, yourself is a very, very small part of the larger subjectivity that's created. Because if you look at the way in which experience, for example, is narrated on Facebook, traditionally, when we talk about blogs or when we talk about the ways in which experience was narrated online, it was a representational mode in terms that we were very happy and comfortable to think about blogs as extensions of diaries or of autobiographies of certain sort, because there is one narrator with one vantage point who is now saying that 16 people came, this is what all the 16 people did, and this is my narration of that entire process. Instead of that, now you have a simulated experience where I have 140 characters to write about, and all I say is I was at a party yesterday, or tomorrow I can go back and saying I was at Periphery's yesterday. And then each participant here kind of adds into the layer of what happened at Periphery's through different kinds of modes. So that somebody might be doing pictures and tagging them, somebody else might be actually doing videos, somebody might be producing a critical commentary, but it is only in that certain coded experiential simulation that what happened at Periphery's comes to life. So there is not one vantage position from one untainted self, as I said, who is present here and now has the ability to narrate the entire experience. So in some ways, it's also fracturing of the narrative in different ways. And so this was just some of the ideas I was working with in terms of looking at network and, you know, not a participant, but a stakeholder. Because then what happens in terms of risk is a very different question, because the risk is in the formation of the network, and it is equally contingent upon each node of the network. But also because the networks work in this really interesting way, especially with digital networks, that when a node collapses, there are other bypasses and circumcisious routes which you could take in order to kind of find new ways of sustaining that network in certain ways, which is what happens in most digital networks especially, or in the very architecture of the internet, that if there is a blockage of some sort, there is a way to bypass it and information keeps on traveling through it. And maybe social relationships within those networks also function in a similar pattern. Monica actually said that there is a discomfort about the fact that there is a replaceability in the network theory. For me, that is the strength of a network. That while each one of them is unique and they have a certain contribution to make to that particular network, the unavailability of one of the resources does not collapse the entire project or the community. That there are different ways by which coping mechanisms are put into place so that different nodes can acquire different kinds of roles, and the relationality basically allows them to produce a sustainable model, which becomes much more interesting then. Okay.
I think what you said is really interesting, because it perhaps possibly produces a third term for thinking about, which is not the spectator, not the user. And I am quite increasingly interested in the figure of the lurker and what they bring to a network, like an electronic mailing list, for instance.
Lurker.
A lurker is not a spectator, because they're not at all, I think, passive. If spectatorship is premised on passivity, which we could dispute. But a lurker is also not an active user. I mean, they're not using, but they're using up bandwidth, which is an interesting position. That they're in a sense occupants of network positions. Occupants of what we now realize is not infinite space, it's finite space. And their presence, and there are moments when, for instance, when I am reacting to a posting or I'm making a posting, where the enormous burden of thousands of lurkers is actually very visible to me. That this is not something that is going out into the domain of the six people who constantly quarrel in an online community. It's actually going, this quarrel is being staged, and everybody could be laughing at us, but we don't know. And the power of that silence is actually quite formidable. And I think, while I appreciate that point, I do think that the earlier understanding that we all used to share of the destruction of a node is not being such a calamity, because we could always reroute around it. I'm beginning to rethink that position, because I think what happens is that assumes that networks do not have histories. And networks do have histories, and by now they have really complex histories. And that complex history is produced not only by the actors in the network, but by also the silence of the thousands of lurkers. And it's been a real, in some senses, an existential problem for us vis-a-vis the reader list, because the Sarai reader list, because of our commitment to keeping it an unmoderated list, and the consequences of that, which are quite often difficult for all of us personally. At the back of our minds, there's always the option we could pull the plug. And many times, Monica and I at different times, Jivesh, all of us have said, let's pull the plug. We created this network, we can pull the plug, and we can. And often the assumption behind that statement is that if everyone is so interested, they can always start something on their own, nothing stops them. What's very interesting for me is that the people who create the greatest amount of offense on the reader list, who constantly produce the greatest amount of hate speech, for instance, are the ones who are really concerned about its closure. Because they will be denied a history the moment that happens. Because their reputations and even their notoriety is dependent on the histories of their posting, on the histories, the seriality of their appearance. And which means that people are really invested, in a sense. They risk a lot on the idea of an online biography or an online history and an online reputation. Which makes me think that we need to rethink some of our understandings of the life and death of networks, because they also imply, therefore, the life and death of histories and biographies. And often, I mean, you could say that some people act in a suicidal fashion, that they produce their own terminal illnesses online, which again makes us think about networks differently. I mean, are there some networks that produce their own pathologies, that produce their own histories of derangement? I mean, it's not to make a value judgment, it's just to enter a different realm of the diagnosis of diagnostics of networks, in a sense.
So I completely agree in terms that I don't want to produce this really network-neutral theory where all the nodes are easily replaceable, but the ability of the nodes to have residual histories, which are outside of the networks as well, and even if the networks collapse or the nodes get destroyed, the way in which those histories and information can travel to recreate certain kinds of simulations, because we're not looking for an exact replacement or a representation of that node, but a simulated node, which can carry on at least the basic functions that that node was supposed to do, is for me interesting. I'm very curious that you brought in the whole notion of the lurker, and especially with the Sarai reader list, which is, as any researcher can... Yeah, I'm an absolute lurker on Sarai Reader's List. I mean, for me, it is interesting because it links up to another position of a Schadenfreude spectator or a user or an artist or whatever you might want to call it. For me, one reason to push the spectatorial boundaries of that particular definition, and that's why I was asking you in the beginning of the discussion, are you saying that things which are outside of the realm of spectatorship, can we kind of bring them into it when we're giving it a lexical turn? Is because of this, that for me, and I might be very wrong in my reading, but a spectatorial position always presupposes a normative subject and in that position. That different kinds of spectacles and frames and representations are for validating a spectatorial position which either gets gratified because of the kind of normativity is being represented, or it otherwise gets into sheer indignation because that kind of gratification is not available to you. So tracing it all the back to the notions of tragedy, where, you know, where Aristotle said that certain kinds of actions will only be reported and not enacted, because it will then disgruntle your normative spectator who expects a certain kind of decorum and decency. Or coming all the way into the Indian S.K. Patil Commission reports on cinema and what is this normative cinematic subject who will now sit and consume cinema in a certain sort of a way. We have always presumed that mainstream art or mainstream cultural production caters to this normative subjectivity. So that this constant disappointment then that most mainstream cinema, even when it raises the most complex of questions, will eventually resolve it in a way which only reinforces a certain dominant aesthetic of that particular time. That it will only reinforce the gratification of the normative subject. And we are all, and this is normativity in a slightly non-normative way, which is not to say that there is only one normative subjectivity, but a normative subjectivity which is presented by us so that, you know, the worst criminal will try to justify about how he or she is actually a normative and a good subject and a good human being. So to think of Schadenfreude is the German word which basically talks... Schadenfreude, sorry, my German is abysmal. All right, Schadenfreude. Schadenfreude is the German word which talks about the evil pleasure somebody gets out of watching somebody else's misfortune. Yeah. So that if you saw Ram Gopal Verma Ki Aag, for me that was a Schadenfreude spectatorial position, because you were laughing at Ram Gopal Verma's misery at how bad that film was and how it bombed in theaters, right? But that for me is post spectatorial in many ways. But to try and imagine the lurker as exactly that. A certain sort of a witness of a spectacle, but an evil, completely non-normative, evil subjectivity which is laughing, completely laughing at the expense of a spectacle where other people's emotions have been invested in it, other people are fighting and crying and screaming, and there is this chuckle that you produce on their behalf. And I think it's an interesting position within a network which the spectatorial position did not offer. That in certain sort of avant-garde position, maybe you do, but even then, there is a certain political consciousness that you are supposed to represent and embody, so that when the darkest of cinematic moments happen, you feel a pang and then you can go and emotionally invest in it. But the Schadenfreude evil position, which is generally attributed to supervillains in comic book heroes, you know, who laughs and chuckles when the heroine is dying, or Gabbar Singh, who's basically saying, you know, asking Hema Malini to dance from here or something like that. Those kind of positions, when they are available to somebody who is not a part of the production, so to speak, is for me a contribution of the network or of the distributed system in some ways. So for me, that's what a lurker brings to the reader's list or to any other sort of a space. That the ability to then not only be invested, not be invested in that problem in terms, let's say, to, I'm sorry to bring the reader's list back, but let's say for the problem of the Kashmiri Pandit, which does overtake a lot of the conversations on the list, my ability to not engage with it does not prevent me from being a part of that particular space. And that my lurker status actually adds to the institutional wealth or the depository of that particular network. That if you are indeed aware of the fact that your audience is more than the normative subject that you are engaging with, because even the normative subject on the other side who you are fighting with is still in that condition of normativity, where they are offended by your political views and concerns. And here is somebody who is a part of the network, is interested in sustaining it, which means that the only times I have actually unlurked on the Sarai list is whenever there has been a call for shutting down. And then I have written saying, no, please don't shut this. What will I do without the Sarai readers? Right? So I just wanted to bring that position as well, because if you are indeed challenging, Stephen, the whole notion of a spectatorship, then this is where, for me, the challenge comes in. Absolutely, it does. But it's a third position that I'm giving to you, that it's not spectatorial and it's not of use value, but it's something else.
Okay, that I'm going to need some time to digest that. That very penetrating thought, because my experience as a lurker is relatively limited, and it was not interesting. It was determined by the fact that I didn't feel at the level to engage in the conversation with those. I mean, I was very interested in what was being saying, but I'll give it some thought. But let me ask you a question which also has to do with the origins of spectatorship. You know that Nietzsche, in The Birth of Tragedy, argued that tragedy was a representation in theater, was invented because the elders, the aristocrats of the city-state, were concerned with the bacchanalia. They were concerned that after a week of inverting the social relations, that there would be no particular reason that the people, the stakeholders, as it were, would go back to tilling the ground and sweeping the floors. They would just behave like drunken kings forever. And so what tragedy did was transform those people into spectators of what the kings feared most, regicide. And that is the essence of the tragedy, is that they take a certain pleasure, an aesthetic pleasure, in contemplating the regicide, but at the end of the spectacle, they return to their position. So no matter how engaged they are in the construction of the aesthetic object, they are repacified in terms of their role within a social hierarchy. How do you see that? Aristotle called that device catharsis. How do you see and I see that as one of the reasons why I would say that Jacques Rancière is engaged in a contradiction in term in talking about the emancipated spectator, because it's true that subjects can be emancipated and be spectators. It's not that I'm saying we should never talk about spectatorship, it's just that I wonder why what compels him to try and theorize this emancipation of the spectator, and what compels or what interests the art world, the mainstream art world, in defending this notion rather than engaging with different and more extensive and encompassing terms. But anyways, how would you see the relationship between your Schadenfreude model of spectatorship and this cathartic mode described by Aristotle?
Does anybody else want to answer? No. Okay. Three things. The first, that for me, the condition of Schadenfreude is interesting because it allows me to kind of look at the kind of reticences which produce the spectatorial positions that we have taken for granted, especially in the case of India, where the spectator is also complicit in then not only endorsing a certain dominant erstwhile position which the nation state expects him or her to take, but also in taking a status quo position in a lot of cultural things that happen around us in terms of the social and the political. So to not imagine the spectator constantly in this condition of complicity, where he or she constantly works at the annihilation of the non-normative urges, in which case, as you were saying, the notion of regicide, for example, but actually celebrate them in certain forms, and that it is within the non-normative that, for me, any sort of negotiation or subversion actually comes from, which is why we also make the distinction between, let's say, the artist and the spectator, where it is the role of the artist to then surprise, startle, scandalize, and provoke the spectator into at least taking temporarily a non-normative position, so to speak, through art, and which is what the distinction between a culture industry and an art industry would be, that art in some ways has this capacity to use Longinus's notion, drive you into sublimity, but this is not sublimity which is just an aesthetic rapture, but also political engagement with different kinds of formations around you. So that's one. The second, I think, interestingly, the whole notion of catharsis is something that, I mean, I think it's been very variously defined. For me, catharsis is not about the representation itself, but the kind of gratification one gets because you justify the killing of the non-normative self in a spectatorial position. That there is, like, for me, I'm sorry, I'm going to draw an Indian parallel, but this is the Rab Ne Bana Di Jodi, as a movie, as a cinematic object, which is a story about Shah Rukh Khan, who plays a very, very non-bratish, new urban kind of a lover, who gets married to somebody, and then in order to woo her, he takes up a bratish, non-normative position, who lies, who cheats, who flirts, who drinks, who romances with the girl, and so on and so forth. And there is the resolution in the movie, there is a point where the normative and the non-normative come together. And for me, the sheer pain of watching Shah Rukh Khan actually taking up the normative position, which is the one that he's always taken, despite the fact that the movie is making a claim about Shah Rukh Khan being a new kind of a lover in this particular movie. He's not all the other Rahuls that he has played, from Dil To Pagal Hai to DDLJ, for example. It is there. So there is, I'm saying that within the spectatorial position, within catharsis is not just a way of coping with what's happening in the represented frame. It is not, as Aristotle talked about, some sort of a pressure-relieving valve. But for me, it is the soothing balm you get for annihilating the non-normative impulses because you are now made complicit by the frame to reproduce yourself in a certain way. And especially when this moves into digital networks, where you are not, strictly speaking, in a spectatorial position, and where you are constantly able to, because of certain mechanisms, sometimes it's escapism, sometimes it's alter egos, sometimes it's avatars, and because all of it is not essentially you, or all of it is not all you, that my one avatar here who has a Schadenfreude position is able to then recreate this particular spectatorship is for me very interesting. So for me, the catharsis relationship is actually about the annihilation of the non-normative self that happens within the spectatorial body. And I cannot take credit for this theory because this is something that I'm drawing from a lot of science fiction analysis and narratives coming out of Taiwan. So this is a theory which is being proposed by Amy Perry and Liu Rongpong. And I can kind of send you the paper because they talk about the sci-fi as especially a male-dominated, genre. And what is the kind of gory, violent sci-fi that's coming out of Taiwan, and why female spectatorship is increasing, and why this is not some sort of a misogynist patriarchal trope. Because in those movies, women's bodies get heavily mutilated or distorted, women's reproductive roles get distributed onto different kinds of bodies and so on. And they're talking about how the pleasure and the catharsis that you get from a Schadenfreude position is this, that you have now killed not a character in the narrative, but the character which was stopping you from engaging with all the elements of the narrative. that the only engagement you had so far was with your knights, errant knights in shining armors, or in uncouth villain heroes, or in feminine beauties, and so on and so forth, all the normative characters. But how is it, for example, that nobody voluntarily says that they had a relationship with Gabbar Singh or with Dr. Strangelove when they were watching those movies? So they're saying that this ability to then annihilate the normative self, which is containing your impulses for subversion, is actually where catharsis is located. So I can definitely send you a paper, anybody who's interested in reading it.